All right, we'd like to call the Fish and Wildlife Subcommittee to order. This is Wednesday, March 4th, our second subcommittee meeting of the year here. We have a fairly ambitious agenda before us today, so we do want to get started. And I do know that there are some members of the subcommittee who are in competing committees meeting right now, so they'll be coming in shortly. Again, it's our intention to lay over all of these bills for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill, which we hope to pass out of this subcommittee next Wednesday, the 11th. So without further ado, Senator Bach, you have a couple of bills for us today. Should we start with Senate File 281?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I received a letter, very nice handwritten letter from a constituent. It's dated December 7th. And if I could just read you a little part of it, you'll understand why I was interested in a bill. It says December 7th, 1914... Not 2014, but it says, dear Senator Thomas M. Bach, I'm an 84-year-old hunter. I have hunted all my life. The only years I didn't hunt was when I was in the service. This hunting season in our area was bucks only. During the season, I never saw a buck. In my younger days, I could sit almost all day. Now I can sit maybe 2 hours. The windfalls are higher and the hills are steeper, he said. And then he went on to say how he had contacted the DNR office to see if he could get a doe permit, and they told him no, and they told him, the DNR up on the North Shore told him, contact your legislator. So, I mean, to George's credit, he wrote me a letter, and I read it, and it was, frankly, I thought such heartfelt feelings from a constituent that I thought I'd bring a bill in front of the legislature for them to consider. And so when I contacted Mr. Knopf, I thought, well, gee, what should I put, 84 years old in here? Should I put 80 years old? And I kind of, a lot of people have asked me, well, why did you pick 84? Picked 84 because George said he was 84. And it's something I feel pretty good about. I mean, once in a while we get a chance to do something for just regular citizens back in our districts that have a very legitimate concern. So I bring it to you for your consideration. It won't cost the state any money. Sure. It just will mean that in years, I suppose, when there's a lottery system for doe permits, the DNR will probably have a couple less doe permits available for other people to access. But I don't know how many hunters might be impacted by it, but it just seemed like a pretty reasonable request to me. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I sure appreciate your support and glad to answer any questions.
Well, thank you, Senator Bach. We certainly saw the coverage I think this had in the Star Tribune a couple weeks back, and it seems like a great story. And you know, it's not every day we're able to do something so meaningful for our constituents. So I would say this may have a strong likelihood of finding its way into our omnibus bill. But for the day-to-day, we'll probably end up just laying this over.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I got a call shortly after that. I believe it was an Associated Press story that ran in much of the statewide media. I got a call from the NBC, the NBC affiliate out of Duluth. And the reporter called me and he says, I'd like to talk to you about this bill you have for this 84-year-old hunter that I read about. And I said, sure. I said, I'll be happy to. I said, where are you? He said, I'm sitting in his driveway. So George got to get himself on Duluth Television. I'm not sure if the NBC affiliates picked it up down here. But I got the nicest thank you from George. He was just so impressed that somebody at the legislature would care about what he thought. That it's a pretty meaningful civics lesson for all of us, I think.
Very good. Well, thank you for bringing this to our subcommittee, and we would like to help you help George. So thank you.
Thank you.
There are no questions on Senate File 281, we will lay it over for possible inclusion. And now we can move to Senate File 1020.
Well, Mr. Chairman, another bill on my legislative agenda that's constituent-driven. One of the state's veterans' homes is up in Silver Bay, Minnesota. It's actually was a school at one time, and like much of rural Minnesota, when our rural communities ended up kind of downsizing due to population loss, the city of Silver Bay was looking for a use for the old school. Very good building. And Rudy Perpich was governor at the time, and they made a decision to site a Minnesota veterans home there. And it's a wonderful facility, and I've been there many, many times, helped them get some bonding over the years to make improvements to the building. And but there's an individual just outside the city of Silver Bay who decided he wanted to give these residents of the veterans home an opportunity to hunt. So he, at his own expense, he set up, let me call it a row of trailer house type buildings with windows in them, and goes to the annual expense every year of developing food plots. So there's a reason to attract the deer, much like a garden site. And those of you that have gardens in rural Minnesota know how they attract deer. And he has invited residents of the veterans home an opportunity to come out and hunt, all for free, kind of a wonderful community service, a great citizen that I'm very proud of. And, well, they kind of ran into the same thing this last year. It was bucks only, and, you know, bucks are a little more skittish about coming into the open during the day. And so of the veterans that came out there, no one had the opportunity to shoot at a deer this year. So he contacted myself and Representative Dill and said, you know, it would be nice, this is a very good program, if these individuals could have a doe permit. They're willing to buy the license, just want to be able to have the opportunity to harvest the deer. So Representative Dill actually got this bill jacketed. I jacketed the earlier one that just allows residents of veterans homes to be able to get an automatic doe permit to be able to engage in a hunting experience. So, again, a bill that constituent-driven. This is just down the road from George's place, not probably within 20 miles, I suppose. But we drafted it pretty broadly. Originally, we had thought about, well, and the owner was fine with just having two doe permits. You know, just give us two. So an opportunity for two of the people from the veterans home could come out and shoot. But actually, when we brought it to the department said, hey, why don't we just open it up and let anybody that is interested in deer hunting that's a resident of the veterans home, give them an opportunity to do that. So that's how we ended up drafting it, broader than we initially had thought. But kind of a wonderful, wonderful opportunity for them to still be able to, you know, maybe after a lifetime of hunting like George, still be able to participate in the sport, even though they might seem unlikely they'd have an opportunity. So I bring that for the committee's consideration also.
All right. Well, thank you, Senator Bach. Maybe a question for the author or also Mr. Knopf. On 1.115 here, a person may assist a Minnesota Veterans Home resident. Is there anything in particular that's either authorized or limited by that term, assist?
Well, Mr. Chair, it's done because the term taking under the Game and Fish Laws includes assisting another person to take game. And this way, this would allow that person to assist the person doing it under the Game and Fish Laws. I think this is fine the way it is. You're trying to make sure that they couldn't be considered in violation before for considered taking, because assisting another person to take game is considered taking, and if you don't have a license to take game, you're in violation of the Game and Fish Laws. So otherwise, those people from the nursing home or veterans home would be considered illegally taking game if they were assisting them without their own license.
Well, thank you for clarifying that. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if Senator Bach or Council, if you know how many veterans homes there are in Minnesota.
Senator Brown, you may have stumped us. I'm not sure if we have that.
I don't mean to stump.
I think there are five.
Five.
Okay. Okay.
Right. And I think the one in Minneapolis probably isn't going to participate in this, probably I would not guess. But there may be some other. The others, I believe, are all rural. Are they? Other than Minneapolis. So it could be the other ones. Might want to look at taking advantage of this. I don't know, but the one in Silver Bay actually has had an ongoing program for a number of years allowing veterans to do this.
All right. Well, thank you, Senator. And it seems like another good idea of not only serving our constituents, but those who have made great sacrifice for our state and our country. So with that said, if there's no additional questions or comments, we will lay Senate File 1020 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman of the committee.
Thank you. All right, up next, members, we have Senate File 1033. Senator Benson. All right, welcome to the Game and Fish Subcommittee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. This bill came out of a constituent concern, much as Senator Bach's bills came out of constituent concern. Constituent had gone up to a friend's cabin several times over the course of the summer, did some dirt biking, shot pistol. When they went up to close the cabin, they did one more round of pistol shooting. And as they finished, a DNR officer approached and asked them if they were shooting. They said, yes, they were. And he said, well, you know, you're in violation, and cited the statute and gave them a citation, actually, a pretty hefty one. And constituent friend called and said, how was I supposed to know this? How was I supposed to know that 5 days before the opening of deer hunting, I couldn't shoot at a target range that I'd been shooting at all summer? And I agreed he was right, and so I thought a warning would have been a more appropriate course of action. I understand the DNR has the discretion to give warnings, and that this tool was put in place to prevent poaching and prevent scaring off of deer from a neighbor's hunting land. But, Mr. Chair and committee members, I think we need to consider that as target shooting becomes more recreational in Minnesota, members, we heard testimony in our committee that, in fact, clay shooting sport is the fastest growing extracurricular activity in Minnesota high schools. It's something families are doing together. And I think this issue is going to come up more and more often, and people just aren't aware that there's this special window where you can't shoot at your cabin target range. And so I'd ask for your support on this. I understand there's someone from the DNR who'd like to come speak to this issue as well.
Well, thank you, Senator Benson. And we will be hearing from DNR momentarily. And, sir, again, if you could state your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, committee, for the record, Rodman Smith, Assistant Director for DNR Enforcement. Mr. Chair?
Yes, please proceed.
Mr. Chair, the provisions in the bill, just for a little history, over time, this window has been shortened. It used to be a week before and a week after deer season, and it really was put in place for those people that were either going out early to try shoot a deer or couple days after the season to fill their tag before they had to register the deer. And over time, that window has shortened. We do offer permits to people that if they forgot to sight their rifle in and it's 2 days before, they can call up an officer and the officer can either over the phone or just give them a permit so they can go out and do that shooting. But it is something that we still use today for people that are out wandering around not hunting, but have a rifle, but we're pretty sure they'd probably take a deer if they had the opportunity to. So we do recognize Senator Benson does bring forward a very good issue. I've had a chance to talk with her before committee. We're committed to work with her to address it because we do think there's some room for improvement here for those people that are shooting. So if this is laid over for inclusion, we'll definitely work with Senator Benson on crafting some language that'll make everybody happy.
Very good. Well, thank you, Senator Benson. It seems like there is an opportunity here for promoting education and awareness in this regard, and we will be laying this bill over for possible inclusion, so that will give us the next week to hopefully hammer out some language that's amenable to all parties.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions or discussion at this stage? Well, with that said, we will lay Senate file. Let's see here. We have Senate file
1033
over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, up next we have Senate File 365. Senator Kiffmeyer. Welcome to our subcommittee.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Glad to be here today. I think any subcommittee with such a title is a great place to be in Minnesota.
We tend to agree.
Right. Well, very good. Well, Mr. Chairman, I present to you my bill, Senate File 365. This is a bill, Mr. Chairman, that currently, in current Minnesota law, a person who is on active duty and has successfully completed basic training in the United States Armed Forces, Reserve Component, or National Guard may obtain a hunting license or approval authorizing hunting, regardless of whether the person is issued a firearm safety certificate. I think most of us would presume upon our military as having training in this area, probably way above and beyond a firearm safety certificate. What we did do in this particular bill, Mr. Chairman, is to remove the restriction to only active duty. And so what this does is it includes our veterans, those who have been on active duty but now have left service. Seems like It's not a crucial distinction. I have included in this language, Mr. Chairman, that the commissioner may require written proof of the person's military training as deemed appropriate for implementing this paragraph. That's new discretion, but we felt that it was appropriate to give that as well. And, Mr. Chairman, I have two testifiers with me today that can also speak to this issue.
All right. Well, thank you, Senator. Whoever would like to start, please just state your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Ralph Donay. I'm the chairman of the United Veterans Legislative Council, a former 30-year Marine. I went in the military in 64 and came out in 94. I just wanted to point out here that many times over my 30 years in the military, as in people who are in for 2, 4, 6, 8, 10 years, you have to requalify with your weapon. So it's not just a matter of firing a range one time and then you're done for 10 years or 6 years or however long. You're required every so often to requalify with your weapon, and you have to go through the same safety training that you went through initially when you got your initial training at whatever base you were at. Another reason for doing this for the veterans and for the military is the fact that veterans are disciplined. Part of the argument was, well, they need to know that they can't go hunt on just anybody's property. Military people, of all people, tend to respect other people's rights. And I feel that saying that military people need to go through a course to tell them that you can't just go anywhere and hunt really doesn't make sense to me with all the rules and disciplines that I grew up with all these years. Another point that was brought up was, well, when you go to hunt in other states, you have to have this certification to hunt there. Well, if I'm going to Montana to hunt, I am going to go and find out exactly what Montana requires. And if it requires me to have this safety course in Minnesota, you better believe I'll go take it, because that's one of the requirements to go hunt somewhere else. So, and summarizing here, I think if we're this concerned about everybody doing this, and Senator Kiffmeyer didn't tell me to say this, but I think it should be a high school graduate requirement. We make every person in the state go through the hunter safety course. I mean, that's the ultimate goal, isn't it, to make all hunters in the state safe. But I think that requiring the military to do it, because the other point is oftentimes you find out today that you get to go on vacation tomorrow. Well, did you have time to do your prior course? We had people coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan and stuff that couldn't go deer hunting because they hadn't had the course. They didn't know they were going to get to come home on leave. They got here. We couldn't get a hunting license for them because oftentimes sailors on a ship, they don't know for sure when that ship's going to pull into port. They don't know if they're going to pull into a port where they can get air transportation back home. So all of these factors really affect how a veteran and how active duty folks can get the opportunity to come home to Minnesota and do what they love to do. Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you, Mr. Denny. All right. Yes, Senator?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My other testifier will introduce himself as well.
All right. And please, sir, if you could state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Elmer Eichelberg, and I'm a veteran, and I live in St. Michael, Minnesota, and I'm a member of the American Legion. Really, after two individuals here spoke before me, I concur totally with their input, and so I support the bill.
All right. Well, thank you, sir. We appreciate that testimony and your support.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did have another comment, but
yes,
Mr.
Senator.
Chair, it could be a closing remark, and instead, if you would like to just have questions first or somebody else who wants to testify. Well, Just wanted to let you know.
Yes, please. If there's anyone in the audience who would like to testify to this bill, please approach the witness table. And, sir, if you could just state your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Tim Spreck. I'm here speaking today on behalf of the Minnesota Weapons Collectors. I had hoped to have the president of the organization here, but he was called away on some other business, so you're kind of stuck with me.
We'll make do.
Minnesota Weapons Collectors is the largest and oldest organization of its kind in Minnesota, with a history going back over 50 years. Their organization is not only about collecting, but it's about sports shooting, promoting sports shooting, and safe and proper handling of firearms of all kinds. Their membership is heavily skewed toward military, both veterans and current, as well as retired law enforcement and a number of other related trades. The organization is very supportive of this. They feel that we need to honor our military in every way possible, and removing impediments to them being able to partake in hunting activities makes a lot of sense. So that's the only comments I have. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Spreck. Again, if you could state your name.
For the record, Rodman Smith, Assistant Director for DNR Enforcement. Mr. Chair?
Yes, please proceed.
Mr. Chair, just to frame this issue a little bit more, this issue has been around the Capitol for a number of years, and the legislature has addressed it in a couple of different ways. Currently, as you know, the active military, there's that exemption. We've also gotten rid of the field day application for the active military people, so they don't have to go through and actually do the shooting of the 22s. So really the only thing they'd have to do is go take the online course. And another way we've addressed it is that we do have in Minnesota 2-year apprentice options. So if there is somebody that came out of the military and wanted to go deer hunting and they didn't have the firearm safety, they have 2 years that they could go deer hunting under an apprentice application, so that they would have 2 years then to complete the training. But one thing we want to remind folks is that firearm safety is more about shooting a gun. And I'm sure that the people in our armed services are very well-trained, understand the very safety components of actually shooting a firearm, but what we're seeing in the field when it comes to hunting is we're not seeing people get hurt by firearms. We're seeing them get hurt climbing in and out of deer stands. We're seeing them getting hurt other aspects of hunting, and that's what some of this hunter education does, is kind of does that. Just like Senator Benson's last bill, one of her concerns was that people don't know the law. How are they supposed to know the law? Part of hunter education is we do go through and teach people some of the basics of the law, so I think some of those people might be missing out on that educational component. There's also familiarization with archery and muzzleloader, which I don't believe they teach in basic training nowadays. But so there's much more to it than just the shooting and handling of a firearm. But I think the biggest concern we have at the department is that currently our firearm safety program is certified through the International Hunter Education Association. And what that does for us is it gives us a reciprocity agreement with all the other states in the union that also belong to the International Hunter Education Association. There are Western states that require anybody, no matter what your age, to have a firearm safety certificate if you're a non-resident to come and hunt in their state. And currently, they recognize Minnesota because of the reciprocity agreement that they have, and because of the certification we have through the International Hunters Educational Association, that they'll accept that. Our fear is that if we continue to expand people and exempt people from having firearm safety, that we could lose that certification. There is actually a conference once a year, International Hunter Education Conference. This is a topic not just here in Minnesota but nationwide about veterans and having to take firearm safety, and there's a pretty strong line drawn in the sand, and there isn't any state yet that has gone to the lengths that this bill would do, and we're really fearful that we could lose our accreditation and then could lose that reciprocity. So what that could mean is somebody from Minnesota who wasn't a veteran who has a firearm safety certificate, if they wanted to go to Western State, would actually have to take that Western State's firearm safety program if they wanted to hunt out there. So that's one of our big concerns that we have with the bill as written. All right. I can stand for questions.
Okay, well, thank you. I have one quick question. You referenced the online course that's available for folks. Just curious, if someone were to lack access to reliable, internet or something like that, what sorts of alternatives would that individual have in taking that sort of curriculum?
Mr. Chair, we also have a take-home that they could do, so that we could mail them the packet and the paper and all that, so they could do it at offline also.
All right. Well, thank you. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, is there a fee for this course?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, the online course, I believe, runs about $25.
And Mr. Chair, would you foresee, if this bill were to pass as is, would you see a huge increase or a substantial increase in accidents with military folks if it were to pass as is?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, that's hard. That's a crystal ball thing. I don't know if I could give you a good answer on that. I apologize.
All right. Well, if there's no other questions or discussion, yes, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, I'm late. The reciprocity question that comes up on the different states, is it because we're repealing a section 97B15, or because we're adding the new language about the commissioner may require written proof? Where's the reciprocity concern come from,
Mr. Chair, Senator Hoffman? Currently, there are states that allow active duty military not to have firearm safety, but it's active duty. This would expand it to anybody that's successfully completed basic training. So that brings up a whole another group of people, so that wouldn't have to take firearm safety. And that's kind of the concern nationwide. There's actually even talk about doing something at a federal level to address this, so all states are on the same playing field when it comes to our veterans and hunter education throughout all the states.
All right. Well, thank you. With no additional questions, Senator Kiffmeyer, if you'd like to.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I find it interesting that we will trust our soldiers to be soldiers, to handle guns, to deal with other people's property, but when they come home, all of a sudden, we don't. And I think that's an unfair burden to place upon them. I think that if we trust them in one area, we can certainly do so. This is not a general population situation that is coming from zero and needs to be educated. Matter of fact, this firearm safety certificate is the same one that our grandsons and 12-year-olds take in order to be out, and then they will be okay to go out in a tree, in a field, and handle property. Certainly someone who is over 18, who has served in the military, had that training, is certainly going to be as well qualified as a 12-year-old who simply took this course. So I think we got to recognize the situations that are in here for our military, active duty, and for our veterans. In regards to the out-of-state issue, anybody who is going to go hunting out-of-state has been testified by our own veterans, is in a situation then where they should comply with those out-of-state. But my concern here, and I think we should be concerned with our Minnesota veterans and our Minnesota residents who are being in a situation of coming home, and this is one of those things that I think a lot of us understand, whether it's fishing or hunting or some of these things, the special joy and the enjoyment of Minnesota that comes with doing so, more than just the actual, it's called, do you enjoy the fishing or just catching fish? Well, it's a bit of both, and same thing with the hunting. It's very, very important to those who have that experience. And so this is a Minnesota bill for our Minnesota active duty and our Minnesota veterans that I think we in Minnesota can decide that for them, acknowledging their training well beyond a 12-year-old firearm safety certificate, are well qualified to be able to handle that responsibility, and we should accord them that through our Minnesota law. This is a constituent who brought this to my attention who was so looking forward and thinking that certainly this was possible for him, felt very disappointed in returning home and not being able to hunt. He is disappointed at that, and on his behalf, I bring forward this bill for your consideration. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, I hope we will have your support.
All right. Well, thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. We appreciate you bringing this bill to our attention, and certainly we want to try to address concerns that come to our attention regarding these matters. And in the subcommittee, we do try to craft that right balance between promoting fishing and hunting and trapping opportunities and promoting safety at the same time. So we have a week here before we assemble the bill to engage DNR and others and try to get this in good shape to move forward. Senator Brown, do you have a question?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to echo Senator Kiffmeyer. This is a common sense bill, and I sure hope to see it in the omnibus bill.
All right. Very well. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. And we will lay Senate File 365 over for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, we have Senate File 722. Sarah Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Until just a couple of minutes ago, this would have been the smallest committee that I've ever actually spoken in front of. But now that the two distinguished gentlemen that came to the committee, welcome.
Who was that?
Well, Senator, we all want to hear your impassioned testimony.
Well, I'm trying to give out some comments, and it doesn't even work here, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry.
He's referring to me.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I bring before you today Senate File 722. 722 is a bill that, let's just say, it probably would be one leg of the three-legged stool that has been kind of looming around the Capitol since I've been here for 9 years. What that is basically is that I've been trying to, with other legislators, pass the scopes on muzzleloaders here in the state of Minnesota. And I guess I don't have to remind you as to how that's gone for me, not too well, but there are still people out there that would like to see something done. So this year I came up with the idea similar to what we, and you were gracious enough to put in the bill last year, I think with Senator Hoffman and probably everybody on this committee's ability to pass an agreement on a putting the 60-year-old back in the tree with the crossbow. This is a keeping the folks that are 60 years old and older in the tree with the help of a scope on the muzzleloader. So it's a long way to get to where I intended to go today here, but nevertheless, I think it's a good idea. In fact, you'll notice that the co-author is one that has been, I think, probably verbally against the, in general, scopes on muzzleloaders, and I think by having his signature on here, it's quite clear that around here you have to compromise, and that's what we're doing here. And I have with me today information with regards to why I came up with the age 60. I can certainly hand it out to you if you'd like, or I could, you know, just describe it. I do have something with regards to the sight of the hunter at age 60 and what happens. It does deteriorate, and I do have that in my file if you'd like to look. But I know you're in a hurry today, and I do have with me today the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association would like to testify on behalf of this, and I think last year they may have testified as well, and I appreciate him coming here, so we'll let him give you some input if I could.
Very well. Well, Mr. Bennett, if you'd like to state your name for the record.
Thank you. Corey Bennett, representing the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, and yes, I've testified on this bill several times.
Welcome back.
Well, thank you very much. The Minnesota Deer Hunters Association has backed the use of scopes on muzzleloaders for several years now. We certainly would support a broader approach this year. However, we do understand that sometimes you have to compromise and sometimes you have to get what you can get. And so we do support this bill. As Senator Engelbretson said, last year we also supported the use of crossbows for those over 60 years of age and older. And we will be, again, supporting this for the same reason. For us, it's about keeping people out in the field and keeping those hunter retention. And if this is a way that we can keep our older hunters out in the field and enjoying what they enjoy, keeping the tradition alive, maybe with their kids and their grandkids and going to deer camp and all those things that go along with it, then I think this is well worth it. And I certainly would support keeping those people and keeping that tradition alive. And so, Mr. Chairman, we do support this, and I can stand for any questions.
All right. Senator Osmick.
So, Senator Engelbretson, this is not your Wile E. Coyote bill that's going to go splat in the end because Senator Bach is on it today?
Senator Engelbretson, you want to respond to that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Osmick, you know, we always hear about the folks in Minnesota wanting us to come down to the legislature and get along and compromise. And I think this is the, you know, before you can walk, you have to learn how to crawl type situation. But it is, in all fairness and all sincerity, you know, the when we go to the DNR and we buy a license to take an animal, how do you take that animal, I guess, is a matter of, you know, tradition or a matter of opinion as to how you kill that animal. But I think I can come forward with the proof that if you have the visual aid of a scope on a muzzleloader, which now the muzzleloaders, those of you who do or do not know, are able to shoot up to pretty clearly up to some pretty significant distances. The chance of you are going to be greater of actually killing that animal instead of having it run off being wounded are going to be much better so with the aid of a scope. So long answer, but yes, that's what it is. It's the art of getting along. It's the art of compromise.
Senator Brown, you have a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Ingebrigtsen, I'm not a hunter, so I'm going to ask you to explain something. It looks to me in this bill that opponents would be not in favor of the magnification capabilities. Why would someone not want to have the magnification on a scope?
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's the whole point, is that it would be a magnification. It would aid in the actual identification and be able to see, and with the crosshairs, be able to identify the animal and place the shot a lot more accurate with the aid of a scope like they do on rifles. And mm-hmm. rifles have had scopes on in Minnesota since I can remember hunting, and that's a long time ago. So the aid of a scope is certainly something that's going to help with the proficiency.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I guess I just don't understand why – I'm not understanding why someone would be opposed to the magnification. I'm not a hunter, but I guess I can talk with you offline about that. But it makes sense to me. But.
Very well. Any other questions, concerns? Well, thank you for bringing this issue to us and for your creativity this year. And we, as with these other bills, we will plan to lay this over for possible inclusion. Mr. Spreck, would you like to speak to the bill?
Sorry, I was a little late on the draw here.
No, that's quite all right.
Once again, speaking for the Minnesota Weapons Collectors, they also are in support of this bill.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And that reminds me, anyone else would like to speak for or against this bill in the audience today? All right.
And
Yes, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
And Mr. Chair, if I could add, I don't have a fiscal note, obviously, or anything like that, but I did talk with the DNR, and if they'd like to weigh in as far as what it's going to cost or what it's going to save, but I know it's going to show some savings for staff savings, because they're not going to have to fill out a permit for somebody that asked for a permit that has visual situations. We're not sure, in talking with the Deer Hunters Association, as to how many actual hunters are actually going to decide to stay in the woods with the aid of a scope. After the ripe old age of 60. So I don't know what that number is. I can't honestly bring that forward.
I understand 60 isn't what it used to be, but Mr. Meyer, if you'd like to weigh in on any of these questions.
Yes, Mr. Chair, yes, Bob, don't ask me that. I'll weigh in on this question, please. The fiscal impacts, there would be a slight savings. This work isn't done by our officers. It's done by administrative staff within the St. Paul office. But obviously we did see a decrease in the need for crossbow permits with people over the age 60 after the law was passed last year. So there is that reduction. And if we really want to save money, we should just make it legal to use scopes and muzzle loaders throughout the whole season rather than 60. Then there would be no need for the permits at all. So
I would support that, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Bennett. All right.
I like that.
Any questions or comments at this stage? Well, thank you to the testifiers and Senator Ingebrigtsen for bringing this issue to our attention here today. And as with the other bills, we will lay Senate File 722 over for possible
thank
inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
All right. Up next, we have Senate File 1075. Senator Saxog, you've been waiting patiently from the get-go.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and as somebody who carried the initially carried the scopes on muzzle loaders, you know, 10 years ago or whatever I did, and came up against Senator Bach on the floor numerous times and lost. The other thing you got to remember: this is only during the muzzle loading season. You can have scopes on muzzle loaders any other deer season that we have. So. I think it's a pretty good compromise, too. So that's just my editorial for today.
So that was in reference to Senate File 722.
Yeah.
All right. You're working overtime today. All right.
So Senate File 1076, Mr. Chair and members, we're presenting this. This bill expands the opportunity for individuals to be organ donors through their fishing and hunting licenses. And with me today is Susan Ma Larson, Public Affairs Director at LifeSource, to give a brief presentation and help answer any questions the committee may have.
All right. Well, thank you, Senator Saxog. And if you could, ma'am, state your name for the record.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Susan Ma Larson, And I serve as Director of Public Affairs for LifeSource, and I'm here today to support this bill and answer any questions you have. LifeSource is the federally designated nonprofit organization that is responsible for management of organ donation after death for the states of Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Western Wisconsin. We also manage all tissue donation that occurs after death in that region. So it's our responsibility to work with hospitals and to work with families when individuals die to provide them support and to support their wishes to help those in need of transplantation. Part of our role is to advocate for more people to say yes to donation and provide opportunities for people to register as donors and make sure those opportunities are fulfilled. As the only organization that does this work in the state of Minnesota, it's a significant responsibility and one that we take very seriously. Minnesota's done very well in this area. 64% of our adults are registered. That's much higher than the national average of 50%. But it's quite frankly not high enough. We have about 3,500 people in our state who are waiting for a life-saving organ transplant. Those people will die without a transplant, and their lives depend on individuals, people just like you and I, who say yes to donation and to helping those in need. So coupling donor registration with hunting and fishing license actually provides us a really unique opportunity to reach more people. You get your hunting or fishing license usually every year versus a driver's license, which is every 4 years. So that's a great benefit to us. I just want to tell you a little bit about how this works when somebody registers on the driver's license, because this would be a parallel process so you can understand that. So as you know, when you go to get your license, you have the opportunity to check the box to say, yes, I want to help others through donation. And we work with the Department of Public Safety, provide them education materials, information on donation. They hold all that information in their database, if you will. When somebody dies, whether it's through an illness or an accident or whatever, when after doctors have done everything they can to save their life and they know that's not possible, we're called. And we have a team of people that work 24/7 and evaluate their potential for donation. If they do have potential for donation, it's at that time that our team actually checks whether or not that individual had donor on their driver's license. If they did, we share that information with the family and let the family know what will happen, what the next steps will be to fulfill that donation. If they didn't register as a donor, we ask the family if they would choose donation. About half the time, families say no, and that's a loss. That's certainly a loss, I think, for the family who can receive some sense of healing with their loved one leaving a legacy, and it's, of course, a loss for those thousands of people who are waiting for a transplant. So again, this is a great opportunity. It's a unique opportunity. No state in the country has done this before, so that puts us really on the cutting edge. But that's why you'll notice the legislation was written with a far-out implementation date, so we can work, and we will work collaboratively with DNR to figure out all the little details that need to be figured out to implement this. We're also committed at LifeSource to help support some of the costs of implementation of this program as we figure out exactly what the technology needs are to make this happen. We will limit opportunities, at least initially, to just those getting their licenses online or in the Deputy Registrar's office. Also, great alignment because we do work with the Deputy Registrars when they help people get their driver's license, so they're very familiar with donation. So we think this bill is unique, innovative, and it really presents us with a great opportunity to increase donation and increase the number of lives saved through transplantation. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Well, thank you, Ms. Larson. I have a question right out of the gates here. Right now, if an individual were to have a donor stamp on their driver's license, is that all that individual, all that would be needed, you know, in an emergency room or whatever the setting may be for those organs to be utilized? Or is there a mechanism in place for confirming that? Do you know?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. That's a very good question. That is, in effect, all that they would need. What we do to confirm that is, again, our team actually logs into the driver's license site so that we get that information and we get a printout, a documentation of their wishes so that we can confirm that that is the right person and that those were, in fact, their wishes. We always share that with the family. The family does not have the opportunity to change those wishes, but we do support the family and we share that information so that they're aware.
Okay. And sorry if I've missed this in the bill, but under a circumstance in which an individual already has a driver's license, won't be renewing for a couple of years, but decides to become an organ donor on their hunting license, for instance, will a new driver's license be issued so that the two are consistent, or what sorts of things
Mr. Chair, very good question. That's some of the details we're working out. I don't anticipate that a new license would be issued. That wouldn't be necessary, but we want to make sure that all the systems are connected so we know what their wishes were.
Okay. It strikes me you may want to be consistent, or at least know if one license supersedes the other, or just it's interpreted consistently and accurately. So,
yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any questions? Senator Eaton.
I don't really have a question. I just wanted to thank Senator Saxog for bringing this bill forward. My predecessor authored the original language for Darlene Luther, Revised Uniform Anatomical Gift Act, and I'm glad that it continues.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Eaton, if I can just say, Senator Scheid was a tremendous advocate for donations. She,
she was.
Made a significant difference, and thank you for continuing that legacy.
All right. I should just ask if there's anyone else in the audience who'd like to testify for or against, or yes, sir, or Mr. Meyer, you welcome back to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. For the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, DNR. We have been working with LifeSource and the authors on this bill, and we do support the idea and the concept. However, just a practical application is something that I think we need to step back and have a discussion about. The bill only applies to about 5% of the license sales that actually will occur throughout the state, as it's going to focus on the deputy registers, the DNR office at 500 Lafayette, and the website. So we aren't actually catching all of the licenses that we sell. It also addresses in Section 1 applications. There is no application for a hunting and fishing license. So I'm just going to address some of the practical issues that need to be addressed as this bill moves forward. There is not an application that a person submits. I think most of you know when you buy your hunting and fishing license, we swipe your driver's license. That actually pulls into our database. We don't actually interact with the DPS database anymore because of data privacy issues. And right now, all of the DNR licensing data is classified as private by statute. So the bill actually gives us an authorization to provide that information to LifeSource, but currently it's classified as private. So we have the application issue and how it would work piece that we need to deal with. On lines 2.15 to 2.18, talking about the need to put the word donor on the fishing license and the hunting license, and we have like a bazillion different licenses a person can buy. So I think there's like 130 different licenses or something. But so we need to reprogram the electronic licensing system to do this and find the little space on the actual driver's or your fishing and hunting license where that donor would go. So that's going to drive the fiscal cost of the bill up to a certain degree. On Section H on 2.21, I talk about the reasonable access that's granted to them, which is not a problem as long as the legislature makes sure that they provide that requirement there and people realize that that data is not available to anybody else, not even to sheriffs for the most part. The next section, I, the revocation. So basically what this language says is that when you sign up, maybe your cousin comes in to buy a two-day fishing license or a seven-day fishing license to go to the cabin and they sign up to be a donor. You're registered as a donor forever unless you send a written notice to the commissioner. So many of our hunting and fishing licenses customers may be one time or things like that. So I think that's something that people need to be aware of. And then the bill does provide funding, says reimbursement to state agency for administrative costs. We're working on the fiscal note right now. I know that won't be addressed in this committee. It'll be addressed in other committees. The bill as drafted does have a pretty substantial fiscal note that's there. And then I was somewhat confused as to the delayed effective date, as the bill is effective the day following enactment. So it has a report back next January of 2016, about progress, but once the bill passes, we would need to move into effect. And our licensing seasons run typically March 1st to February 28th. So as this moves forward, we may need to think if we're looking at a delayed effective date of March 1st, 2017 or something like that to give us time to get the system up and running. We are in conversations. Actually, we're going to work to get all of our IT people together to talk about this. I think there's a better mousetrap that can be made to achieve the same outcome, and perhaps one of the goals or outcomes could be to have a statewide education campaign that the DNR could participate in with to capture the 400,000 deer hunting licenses that we sell and the hundreds of thousands fishing licenses that we sell, to educate them on how to work with the Life Source folks to get to that point in time. So we look forward to working with the author and the legislature as this bill moves forward, but I wanted to just raise some of those practical concerns with the language to the committee at this point in time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Any additional questions? Yeah, Senator Osmick.
I'm trying to get my hands around what happens when somebody gets into an accident and becomes and is an organ donor. My understanding is it's on your driver's license, right? And the officer on the scene looks in your driver's license, sees donor, that triggers a sequence of events that takes place. And I'm not sure how much the officer is then going to be, well, I'm going to dig around for the person's fishing license or hunting license that may or may not be inside of the wallet. It could be someplace else. I certainly don't carry my fishing license all the time. I actually leave it in a boat that I use to go fishing all the time. So I'm sort of trying to figure out if you put it on that license, how much are we going to be able to know that that's supposed to be there? And as was brought up by DNR, if you transfer that information over to the department of to another department to put it on the license, then you're going to have to reissue another license, a driver's license, making the modification, which is another cost. So I'd like to sort of hear where you're going with that, because I just envision a mechanical problem as it's been described. The most important thing is the mechanical problem that we're going to have here.
Mr. Chair and Senator. Nobody visualizes the license. The donor's on the license, but that's not what triggers the donation process. So what happens when somebody is in an accident is law enforcement and first responders, their only responsibility at that point is to try to save that person's life. And when they get to the hospital and those efforts have not been successful, that's when actually the federal law kicks in and says in any hospital in the service area that I described for LifeSource where there's a death, we must be called. So we have a team of individuals that are on call 24/7. They take about 25,000 death calls a year, and they take each one of those calls and evaluate if that individual has a potential to be a donor. Once they've determined that, yes, they do have a potential because of that's a medical screening at that point, that's when we check if the individual had donor on their license. So we actually do that check electronically. And so the driver's license is rarely actually visualized to determine if donation. So, and I think that's some of what Bob is talking about, how we have to sort out the details here, is because we maybe won't be actually checking the fishing and hunting license, but it will be the information that is captured in the database that will be critical, that will help us fulfill those individual wishes.
Sir Osmick.
Then one follow-up. I agree starting in Section 2.27, many people think that when your license expires, everything that went with it expires. I think that there needs to probably be some type of language to say up front when you check the box, if you're doing it on a fishing license or a hunting license, that says that gives information to the person who's doing, saying this is not revocable unless you actively do it. It's going to be in place, even though every year you're going to renew your fishing license or hunting license, that it's going to be in place whether you check the box or not, unless you do this, or at least there's some way to go about that.
Mr. Meyer?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Osmick, we would need to make sure that we would revise our Tennyson warning when we are issuing that warning to people to address that concern. And that is one thing that's brought up, but it's been brought up by our staff already.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Senator Eaton.
Same answer.
Okay, very good. All right.
This would be part of the Tennyson.
All right, very good. Any additional questions or comments? Well, Senator Saxon, thank you.
Maybe you could help us here, because we're talking about policy here, are we not? And this, obviously, most of what we've talked about are fiscal impacts. So what would be the way that you want to see this bill move?
Well, I was considering laying this over and allowing for some discussion, and we could act on the bill next week if you'd like to do that. Wednesday we plan on assembling our omnibus bill, and we certainly could move this bill out of committee at that stage. Would that allow you plenty of time to make a deadline and move through the committee process if we decided to move this bill independently?
Mr. Chair, members, I would think that the biggest committee that we'd have to go after this committee would be Senator Tomasoni's Finance Committee. You know, because that's kind of what exactly. We're talking about, a fiscal policy.
So sir,
that sounds like it would work. Yes, thank
yeah.
you.
So we'll just plan on laying this bill over, and we'll continue the conversation.
So it's going to go to him anyway.
Good.
Thank you, Senator Saxon. Members. Up next, we have Senator Anderson with Senate File 252. And you, sir, have been waiting patiently. I think you were here from the outset, so thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate the opportunity to bring Senate File 252 before the subcommittee to hear a plea from a constituent of mine who called about the second week of our going into session saying, you know, I'm 85 years old, and I would really appreciate the opportunity to get for once, before I die, a free fishing license. And I said, well, what makes you think you're not going to make 90? Because that's what it says in statute right now. We have age 90 to get there. And he says, I don't know if I'm going to get to go fishing this year, because he says, I got put in a wheelchair and I'm stuck and I don't know if I'm going to get anybody to help me. So the bill before you, Senate File 252, allows residents to, at the age of 70 years of age or older, fish without having to obtain a license. And because I had some objection and some pushback from some of my members, I brought forward an amendment and that is in the packet, Mr. Chair, members.
Yes, Senator Anderson, we do see the A-15 amendment before us, and we'd like to give you the opportunity as an author's amendment to get this bill in the shape you'd like.
I appreciate that.
So this is the A-15-0097 amendment. Senator Osmick moves. All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
motion carries, and the amendment is adopted. Senator Brown is throwing wrenches in our plans here today. Senator Anderson, if you'd like to proceed, the amendment has been adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. Appreciate your understanding of this. The bill changes the age threshold for taking fish without a license from age 90 to now with the amendment to age 80. My understanding that with this change, we have more people from both the Senate and the House who are more advantageous to seeing this bill go forward. And according to the DNR, if the exemption applies to 80 year individuals and older, the state would probably lose around 19,000 licenses, which are sold to residents here in Minnesota from the age of 80 to 90. That's about 1.6% of all the licenses that are sold in that age. And if it would have been left at age 70, they would have lost about 93,000 licenses from age 70 to 90. So that's about an 8% of the total 1.3 million licenses sold each year. And Mr. Chairman and members, that's basically the long and short of it. I did ask the gentleman's name is George Ashfold. He's from Monticello. And he has said that he's just shy of 70 years of having to buy a fishing license. He started buying his own fishing license at age 16. He's 85, and I figured it out at 69 years of age. And so he was kind of hoping that, you know, we would have changed this a long time ago so that at age 80 he could have had the opportunity to get that free license. But I have a father who is 90, just turned 90 this past year, and when I told him about it, he says, well, you mean I missed it by 10 years? And I said, well, it's not passed yet, Dad. So anyway, it's before you, and I hope you can consider it, and hopefully if there's any questions, I'd be glad to hear from anybody that'd like to bring it forward.
Well, thank you, Senator Anderson. We certainly appreciate you bringing a constituent concern to this body, and there's a theme running throughout the committee today on making it easier for folks into their 80s to obtain licenses hunting and fishing. So are there any questions, discussion at this stage in the game? Well, like the bills before, we'll plan on laying this over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill next week. And again, we want to thank you. I'm sorry. I should give DNR an opportunity. Would you like to speak? All right, please. And if you could, sir, just state your name for the record.
Don Pereira, Section of Fisheries, DNR. Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for the opportunity. We did do a fiscal analysis, but it was before the amendment, so it was okay. From age 70 to 89. So we did just do some real quick calculations because we also have to factor in the fact that we will lose federal revenue from the sport fish restoration program. And so our best estimates right now is that we would have a drop in revenue of about $620,000 from the decline in license sales. So, and that's, the analysis for 70 to 89 was obviously quite a bit more. It was about a $2.6 million drop. So the amendment changing it to 80 again results in a drop in revenue of about $620,000.
And for the committee, could you just describe exactly how this change in law would impact our federal funding?
Sure. So the sport fish restoration program uses basically a formula to apportion. It's an excise tax on everything from marine fuels to fishing tackle. And there's a formula that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service uses to apportion that tax revenue amongst all the states. And one of the parts of that goes in the formula is actually the number of licenses sold in each state. So obviously Minnesota does very well. We sell about 1.3 million licenses across quite a few different license types. So this would we would have a drop in that federal aid income because of that decrease in license sales.
All right. Well, thank you for that. We appreciate that. Any questions? All right. Well, Senator Anderson, we appreciate you bringing this issue to our attention today. And as with the other bills, we'll lay this over for possible inclusion.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you. All right, members. On Monday, the 2nd here, we were able to work our way through Senate File 1303. And if DNR could approach the testifiers table and we'll pick up where we left off, that'll give us an opportunity to end today's meeting having at least gone over at a high level the omnibus game and fish bill as presented from the DNR. The agency bill, I should say. So if you would like to just state your name for the record, and I believe we are somewhere around Section 13, but I could be wrong. So we've made it past that.
Oh, yeah. We did feral swine.
Oh, that's right. We have moved past that.
Mr. Chair, for the record.
Pick up where you like.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Rodman Smith, Assistant Director for DNR Enforcement. Mr. Chair, we did get through Section 17, and then Senator Osmick also had some questions on Section 22, so we jumped ahead a little bit. I do have somebody from our non-game department that could answer more questions if Senator Osmick had more questions about Section 22, so we do have an expert in the room today, but otherwise I can pick up at Section 18 where we left off.
18 it is. Okay, please, if you'd like.
Okay, and Mr. Chair and Senators, we're working from the fact sheet because some of the do you have the fact sheet? I hope.
Yep.
Because there are some of these sections that kind of group together. They're,
sure.
It's one policy change, but there's probably a couple different sections in the bill that are changed. So, Mr. Chair, Section 18 is a response of an incident that happened up in northeastern Minnesota this year where a bear hunter was tracking a wounded bear at night and was actually attacked by the bear and so received some damage or some bodily harm from the bear. And so in response to that, the department has crafted language that would allow a licensed bear hunter who has a valid license to be on foot with a light and a firearm if they're tracking a blood trail of a bear. So this would be an exemption to the shining law. It's restricted to bear hunting and a licensed bear hunter, so that would hopefully avert anything like what happened this fall from happening again. And just anecdotally, we have had bear hunters in the past that have had down bears who've called conservation officers, and we have allowed people to do this in the past. So The big difference between a downed bear and a downed deer, especially bear, is that if they're left overnight, sometimes the meat can get spoiled because in August it's a little hot, and those bear are hot anyway, so you want to skin them out as much as possible. So this is in response to that issue that happened up in northern Minnesota. Section 19.
Sarah Brown has a question here.
Yes, yeah. Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering if we could amend this to say bear or wolf.
Ooh. Boo, yes.
Oh, okay. I was just curious.
Sarah Brown, you were missed the other day, so you've certainly brought a lot to the committee today.
I wanted to see the look on Senator Eaton's face. So.
I hope you're satisfied. All right. Mr. Smith, if you'd like to continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 19 is doing away with the permit requirement to take unprotected wild animals. It's basically getting us into the 20th century. Current law says if you're going to use a radio to take an unprotected wild animal like a coyote, you need a permit. With smartphones and talkie-walkies now with your smartphones, we're just going to get rid of the permit requirement altogether. It will be a substantial staff time savings for issuing these permits, so we're just getting away with that permitting process altogether under Section 19. And then Section 20, Ms. Don Carlos will cover.
All right, please, if you could, restate your name for the record.
For the record, my name is Kathy Don Carlos. I'm Deputy Director for the Division of Fish and Wildlife. Mr. Chair, Section 20 is a policy change regarding establishing bear feeding restrictions. This would prohibit specific feeding with the intent of attracting bears. This does not include bird or small mammal feeding or baiting of bears. It focuses specifically on intentional bear feeding. And really the reason for this is because feeding of bears typically habituates them and changes their behavior over time. And this does cause problems for people living in the area who do not appreciate bear behavior changing. Section 21 has to do with an expansion of the non-lethal hazing when property damage is occurring. You may remember that last year we worked with Senator Brown to allow the use of non-lethal hazing for Canada geese. This year we're proposing to expand that non-lethal hazing to include other species that are causing crop damage. And that includes swans, in addition to geese, it includes swans, turkeys, and sandhill crane. So this provision would allow that non-lethal hazing to take place when it involves game bird species, but it's specifically targeting those four groups.
Sarah Osmick.
So, Senator Sproul, look what you have done. We are bullying geese, and now we have expanded it to bullying poor, defenseless game birds. I hope you're
and I'm happy to see
son.
It. Thank
okay.
you.
Ms. Don Carlos, if you don't mind flipping back to Section 20 real quick, a question was raised. A number of Minnesotans will feed birds maybe with suet or other seed, and bear may be attracted to that. What sorts of things are put in place to prevent that individual birder who's feeding birds from falling a victim to this provision?
Mr. Chair, we understand that there's a lot of different feed materials that are used that are attractive to many mammals. In Section 20, if you look at 11.26 to 11.31, if someone was to be using a suet feeder and they were attracting bear and the bear was continuing to hang around, then once the person was notified that although they were intending to feed woodpeckers, if they were notified that there was a bear starting to use the area more and become habituated, they would have to remove the food for 30 days and then could resume feeding. So that should break the that pattern that was starting to form in the bear.
Thank you. Sir Hoffman.
Thank you. Just on the word habituation or is there a statute that defines the habituation? Did I say that right?
I think you finally got it, Senator Hoffman.
Did so I? Wary?
Yeah. It's strategery. That's what it is, Senator. So is there a defined, in, Mr. Chair, is there something in statute that defines what habitueri is?
Ms. San Carlos.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hoffman, I don't believe our definitions section includes a definition of habituation. I can offer you a common man's definition if you'd like.
Mr. Chair, I just think that when you start to look at something that's got some ambiguity, and I can't even speak today, ambiguous language to it. That you're setting yourself up for somebody's misinterpretation of what, you know, habituation is. There, I could say that word now.
We've got it down. I don't think we can seat these two next to each other next week. So, but Ms. Don Carlos, if you'd like to provide us with a working definition or what you use in layman's terms.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hoffman, habituation is changing an animal's behavior and having that behavior. It's typically changed to unnatural behavior or behavior patterns or movement patterns. So their home range may become shrunk and reduced. So they may be spending more time in a very concentrated area rather than spreading out. The times of the day that they may be active may be changing. So they may be becoming more diurnal or active during the day rather than crepuscular at dawn and nightfall or nocturnal. So there's different patterns that will manifest to show that their natural behavior is becoming changed,
okay,
to something that's altered. And speaking to the point about having something ambiguous, typically what we see is when there is a bear moving from household to household, hitting trash cans or bird feeders, people in the neighborhood will start noticing that, and they have nuisance type behavior. So it's from that standpoint, I don't know if you would call that ambiguous or not. I think at that point the animal is becoming a nuisance, whether it's a bear. You know, typically we don't get these types of problems with raccoons, but they can be habituated as well to wild bird feeding. So with bears, it's a little different because of their size and their potential safety risk.
Okay, resulting. Well, thank you for that. If you'd like to continue.
Mr. Chair, Section 22, again, is the prohibition on luring or feeding to owls. And I don't know if you wanted to go through that or have some more information.
I'm not sure if there's any. I know, Senator Osmick, you had some questions on Monday.
I'm satisfied with that, Mr. Chair. I think, you know, there is no permit fee. There's a permit, and I understand why the permit's there, so that you can enforce it upon people if they decide to go out and bait them. So I think I'm fine with that. If the constituent contacts me, I'm sure he'll talk to me about it, and I think I couldn't explain this.
All right. Very good. Well, thank you, Mr. Smith. If you'd like to proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 23 is just cleaning up to make sure that it's clear in law that a person that is turkey hunting, either archery or by firearm, can also, if they do have a permit to carry issued by the state of Minnesota, they can carry that handgun in compliance with that permit to carry. We've already made those changes for archery deer hunting and whatnot, so this is just making sure that all species that are hunted, those people that do have that permit to carry can carry legally, or the law allows them to carry legally. So Section
can they shoot the turkeys?
That's for rabid feral turkeys.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
continuing with Section 26, this provision would allow the agency to use a preference lottery system for selecting hunters and trappers for three registered fur bear species, Fisher, Martin, and Bobcat. And the intention would be to use this to try to limit over-harvest of the population. Just to give a little background of the situation that we're dealing with currently with Fisher and Martin, we have reduced the number of days of in the season to try to reverse a population decline that we're monitoring now. And that hasn't worked, and so we've reduced the possession limit from 5 to 2. We made that change in 2012. We're still not really being able to turn around the decline in the population. There are multiple things that could be affecting the population. It could have to do with forest management, age of forest out there that they're using. It could deal with the number of trappers pursuing Fisher and Martin. The next step to consider would be to close the season. The agency doesn't want to close the season because they're registered fur bearers. We're collecting important age, sex, gender, and age information on harvested animals. And so by doing a preference lottery system, we'd be able to reduce the harvest, reduce the pressure without losing information about the population. So this would be an additional option that we would use, but we'd use it with great consideration.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Section 27 is clarifying some tongue twister language, I guess, that's in statute right now. We're really not making a policy change. If you read the existing language, it reads a body gipping trap need not be tended more frequently than every third calendar day, and that people read that and scratch their heads. So we're just trying to plain language it and say that they must be checked at least every third day. So it's really no change, just trying to get rid of the tongue twister in the language.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
continuing
Mr. Carlos.
Continuing with Section 28, this provision would expand the current commissioner order authority that we have for changing regulations, fishing regulations on Mille Lacs during the season, to also include Upper Red Lake, whose management we do in conjunction with the Red Lake Band. There is a memorandum of understanding between the band and the agency on how those waters will be managed. Harvest is monitored very closely, and this provision would allow the agency, if needed, to change the regulations during the season as quickly as possible, rather than using a longer process that the emergency rule may take 2 weeks to put into place.
And I should just ask, Ms. San Carlos, is that proposed change consistent with the MOU you have with the band?
Mr. Chair, the MOU doesn't speak specifically to the MOU expects the agency to be able to react when harvest targets are being reached. Doesn't specify how, but just that there's the expectation that we will move, both parties will move as quickly as possible.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, Sections 29 and 31 are together, and what we're trying to accomplish here is that there are a few people that were in the minnow business, and if they didn't do things right, they can get their licenses revoked. But it really hasn't stopped them from being in the minnow business. They kind of are, I guess you could call mercenary minnow people, where they will go and sell minnows to just about anybody that wants to buy them, depending on if they're friends with them that week or not. And so what we're trying to accomplish here is to have minnow dealers list helpers on their license, and they can change the number of helpers, the names of helpers, anytime during the season. The helpers only need to have a angling license, so you could be a minnow helper on two different people's licenses, but it's going to have us get a little better handle on these folks that are out there. It may sound funny, but minnow industry in Minnesota is a very big industry, and it generates a lot of revenue for a lot of people. And so we're just kind of trying to get a little better handle on these people that are out there using our natural resources for profit.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. San Carlos.
Mr. Chair, moving on to Sections 32 and 35. These sections would allow the agency using the good cause clause rulemaking process to remove spearing bans on 11 of the 12 remaining lakes where there are currently spearing bans. The lakes are listed in the fact sheet, but there is a typographical error. Baby Lake, the spearing restrictions would remain on Baby Lake until the entire process unfolds. On Monday, you were briefed by Don Pereira, Chief of Fisheries, on the zonal pike approach that's being considered. And so this relates to that, but we'd like to proceed with removing the spearing ban on the 11 of the 12 remaining lakes. Moving on to Section 33, this provision would allow the agency to refund bear licenses that were purchased by 10, 11, and 12-year-olds in 2013. This was a mistake on the agency's part. We changed the cost of licenses for youth across the board to $5 in 2013, and we made a mistake and we neglected to include the bear license in there. We realized it as soon as the session was over, which was too late, and we had less than 50 non-resident and resident youth purchase bear licenses, and the impact to the agency would be about $2,000 for refunding those, and it would only be for that one season. Section 34 is a provision that would remove from statute and rule the patented name Conibear. We've been requested by attorneys from the company that manufactures these traps to remove the patented name from statute and rule.
Senator Hoffman.
So, Mr. Chair, thank you. That's I've gotten lots of emails regarding Conibear and dogs and lots of phone calls. And can you – is it the removing the name to do what? I mean, what's
– Ms. Giancarlo.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hoffman, we've been requested by the company that their patented – their trademark name, Conibear, is illegally in – is improperly being used in statute and rule.
Okay.
And so everywhere it occurs with Conibear body gripping type trap. And so by removing the name, it doesn't make us more vulnerable to misunderstanding the statutes or rules because of how it's been phrased.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up, so we're going to use the word body gripping and we'll.
Yes,
we'll
that.
San Carlos.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hoffman, that language will stay in.
Okay.
Well, very well. If you'd like to continue, we're getting close to our committee adjourn time and also getting close to the end of this bill.
Mr. Chair, the last section, Section 35, is the repealers. And the repealers, I believe, are on the back, 97A-475 is muskrat farm license fee. There are no more muskrat licenses or muskrat farms. We neglected to get rid of this last session, so this is just cleanup from the unsession stuff that work that was done last session. And then 97B905, there is a surety bond that a fur buyer is supposed to have for $1,000. We really haven't required that for a number of years, so we missed that one too on the unsession.
Okay.
So those are those two, and then the last one. Is what Ms. Don Carlos talked about on sections 32 and 35, removing 11 of the 12 spearing lakes.
Okay. So you can assure us that by removing the muskrat farm license fee, we're not going to be blowing a hole in the budget?
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'm pretty confident I can say it.
All right. Thank you. Well, I just appreciate your testimony today and walking us through the bill. And this committee will be reconvening next Monday at 4 o'clock across the hall. With that said, the committee is adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The Brown Bully Bill expands.
Squirrely bunch today, my God.
Right on time.
There we go.
I don't think we can put you guys to
That was fun. You guys.
Guess we got to have fun. We don't need to stick around tonight.
No, I don't.